Today is Saturday, December 5th, 2020. This is a part 5 Grand Canyon oral history interview with Nancy and Keith Green, spelled G-R-E-E-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Keith and Nancy. How are you?
Good.
Okay.
Good. Keith, maybe let's go back to you today. In 1975 at Phantom Ranch, because Nancy's already got up to 1978. So let's see if we can get you from 75 to 78. Then we'll be all caught up here and close to getting you two to meet each other. What do you remember about Phantom Ranch back in 1975?
I remember it as being, kind of like camp, you know. It was really quite, not very, you know, there were many times when all the cabins weren't, occupied, and, in fact, I remember in the winter time, one time, or several times anyway, I remember in the winter time there was nobody at the ranch. It was snow, of course, on the rim.
Okay.
And that would stop people from coming down,
which
it doesn't do anymore. And so, you know, basically the staff would have the day off. And so I remember one day, one day when it actually snowed down at the bottom, which was a pretty unusual thing, and of course nobody came down, and so we hiked in a couple of groups, I guess, of us, not the whole staff, but a couple of groups of us hiked up to Ribbon Falls just to see what the trail, you know, just to experience the North Kaibab Trail in the snow.
Wow.
And the bridges were all covered with snow, and of course Ribbon Falls was there was snow down either side of it, but it was and ice, but it was you know, still flowing. That was a pretty, I remember that time as being a pretty fun, pretty amazing time. But anyway, that sort of thing would happen. There was a lot of times when there weren't, when it wasn't full. Also, we didn't have nearly as big a staff back then as we do, as there is now. It was nearly as big. I suppose, I guess there were about 11 on the staff.
Okay.
Then, we only had, you know, one setting for breakfast and one setting for dinner. And that was basically the steak dinner. And for the mule riders. I mean, other people could do it, but it was expensive, and mostly hikers weren't interested in paying whatever it was for a steak dinner back then, which is probably a lot cheaper than it is now.
So tell me about the 11 people on staff. What did they do, and how were their duties split up?
Well, the duties were pretty much the same as they were when I left. It's just it took less work to do them.
Okay.
You know, I know, I remember a woman named Alice, and I wish I knew her last name. She was such a lovely person, who was the cook, and she was a really good cook, too. She, you know, the employee meals quite fine.
Keith, if you're doing the breakfast setting and the dinner setting, and the dinner, is always steak. What did the employees eat for, you know, for their dinner to add some variety? I mean, steak and potatoes every night.
No, yeah. No,
how did that work out?
That's what I mean by Alice was a great cook. She would cook really nice things for the employees.
Oh, wow.
What, you know, that was a whole separate dinner. No, we didn't have steak every night. I think we'd have steak on Sunday night. That was the one night we had steak. There was a funny story, though, about a guy, a manager, I think his name was Sue Kobritz, and he was...
How do you spell his last name? Stu?
Oh, Sue Kobritz. Oh, boy, I wouldn't know.
C-O-V-E-R-I-T-Z?
Kobritz, V-R-I-T-Z, I would guess. Sue Kobritz?
C-O-V-R-I-T-Z.
No, B as in boy.
C-O-B-R-I-T-Z. Kobritz. Got it. Thank you.
Yeah, Kobritz. Who was extremely cheap. And so he would... So the employees got... he found that the cheapest meal he could give the employees was stuffed peppers. And so that's what we had, what the employees had. This was before I was there. So that's what the employees had every day. But anyway, one time they served the stuffed peppers. And, of course, the cowboys ate along with us. And I swear back then they got all the cowboys from the prison or something. They were all pretty rough, scary people to me anyway. But anyway, one of the cowboys grabbed Stu and threw him up against the wall and held a knife to his throat and said, "We're not eating. We're not eating stuffed peppers tonight. We're having steak." And of course, Sue was like, okay. And so we had steak every time that cowboy came down.
Oh my gosh.
Anyway, this Alice, she was really good. And there was a guy named, well, of course, I was, you know, anyway, there was a guy named Chris who was a really great guitar player. I remember that. But he liked to do the lodge job, basically cleaning the lodge and washing the dishes. That's that job. Back then, the dishes were all done in a three sink method. Right?
Yep.
Describe that. Yeah.
Yep. You did?
I did. Okay, yeah, the three sink method with and he liked bluegrass music, so he'd blast the bluegrass music, and we'd do the dance, washing all the dishes, and he ended up, I think, making guitars back east. But anyway, you know what? Everybody was about to leave when I, in 1975, when I was just coming down for weekends. You know, I'd get 2 days off when I was, because I was doing housekeeping on the rim, and in my 2 days off, then I could come down to Phantom and spend a day down there anyway, and. Anyway, so I got to know people, and the manager, whose name was Glenn Hogue, offered me a job in 1975 down there, and because of my low vision, the only thing he wanted me to do was be the laundry person. He figured that the laundry person takes the least amount of good vision.
Okay.
This is kind of the story of my life, is all these people deciding what I can do and what I can't do.
Right.
But anyway, so he decided I'd be a good laundry person. So I was always the laundry person for the first year there. It wasn't until Terry or Magda, her name was later, Terry Mache, became manager, that she started giving me the opportunity to do other jobs. In fact, she put me on the rotating list. I was even the cook for sometimes.
Cool.
But anyway,
you mentioned
we're kind of, Alice was the cook and I was the laundry person, and it was the same pretty much every day.
You mentioned when you showed up, there were a bunch of people that quit in 1975.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm looking back at that. They didn't talk about why they were quitting, or they just all said, "Oh, it's time to leave." We just want to go, do something else in our life, and that sort of thing. But I got to thinking that was right after the swimming pool closed.
Oh.
Which is a major change in the kind of what Phantom Ranch was. Before, when the swimming pool was there, Phantom Ranch was a resort at the bottom of the canyon. And when they took the swimming pool out, Phantom Ranch became more like a motel or a hotel at the bottom of the canyon.
Okay.
It wasn't a resort anymore. Because you could go down there just for the enjoyment of, using the swimming pool or, hanging out at the bottom of the canyon. It became just a place to stay, which is kind of a major change in what Phantom Ranch was to people. Then, and I don't have any evidence for it, but I believe, looking back at it, that's why everybody was leaving then. It was just like the swimming pool was gone. The whole essence of what Phantom Ranch was changing, and people were just like, we're out of here.
That swimming pool was in existence in 1942. Do you know when it was built?
It was built by the CCC back in the 30s.
Okay.
So I'm guessing 33 or something like that.
Okay.
I mean, I've got that information somewhere.
Yeah, I'm sure we can look it up, but I was just thinking, wait a minute, I don't remember when Fred Harvey built that lodge down there at what was Rust's camp. I'd never heard about a pool being built there in the 20s, so it makes sense that it came in the 30s.
Built by the Soil and Conservation Corps. So.
Okay. So 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, that's a 40-year run. That's a major change there. That was 19... do you remember when they filled the pool in, what year that was?
It was 70, well, they closed it in 72, I believe, and I'm not sure. Again, I'd have to look that up.
Right.
Something like 71 or 72, they closed it.
Okay.
The first time I saw the pool, was in 72 when I the first time I got to hike across the canyon.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really know what it was when I got there, but what I came to behind the rec center, what now is the employee dorm, there was this big hole in the ground, and it was just full of trash, and it had that construction tape all around it, so you wouldn't walk into it or anything, but it was just, there's a bunch of junk in the bottom of it.
Okay.
This big hole in the ground. And I didn't know what it was at the time, but that was what was left of the swimming pool.
Okay. I was wondering about the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, which I believe passed the House and Senate and was signed into law, I believe, by President Nixon in 1972. And so this change would have happened before that legislation, which would have required public review and comment and all that stuff.
Right.
So so that's how the park still had the ability to go ahead and make a major decision.
Mm-hmm.
That would, as you say, dramatically change the character of that location, that resort would become a hotel.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true.
So when you showed up in 75, that hole full of trash, I'm assuming, was finally covered with dirt.
Yeah. It was actually a Fred Harvey employee, and it was after the flood of 68, so they had a bulldozer down there, a small bulldozer that and they used that to eventually fill in the swimming pool with dirt.
Okay.
And what Roy had done was he had just left the irrigation system the way it used to be before things started to change. The swimming pool, of course, is a whole long story in itself. They tried to save it for a little bit, but the health department was one of the problems one of the reasons why the pool couldn't be there anymore, because they kept creating rules about it. The main thing that they did was they required that the water be that Fred Harvey put in a circulation system made the water all go through filters and eventually it was all kind of an enclosed system, whereas the way the pool was built was that water came in through the irrigation system. The irrigation system was a little like foot deep channel that was dug around all the trees in the ranch.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, it all came together, and well, not all of it, but most of it came together, and went over a little waterfall on the north western corner of the swimming pool, and then into the pool, and then water flowed out of the pool on the southwestern corner back over to Bright Angel Creek, which is where the water came from. So, so it was a, you know, that was the system, that was the way it was built. But then like I said, the health department decided that it had to be an enclosed system, that the water had to have be chlorinated, and all these rules that basically made it so they couldn't maintain the pool.
Oh, I see. And they couldn't just put a chlorinator in there, because that would basically chlorinate the water leaving the pool going back into the creek.
That's correct.
So they would have had to close off the input and the output to keep that chlorinated water entrapped in one location.
Exactly.
I see. Okay. And of course, Fred Harvey wouldn't have wanted to foot that bill.
They did it. I actually did that. They put a chlorinator in.
Oh, they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and closed the pool off. But the problem was that it was open, and this was the '60s, so you had well, the story that I heard anyway was that all these darn hippies, you know, which I was one of them, but anyway, all these darn hippies would come down and they'd just jump in the pool, clothes and all, and get the water dirty, and it would clog up the filters. So they asked the Park Service if they could build a fence around the pool, and the Park Service wouldn't let them. Said no, no pool, no fences. And so it was just a constant problem. I remember one story of Howard Lapp. That's the name I was trying to remember. He was the maintenance person. Anyway,
is that LAPP?
Yes.
Thank you.
I think he was the one. Anyway, he was, again, this is before I was down there, so, but he was the one that had to drive the bulldozer to fill in the pool. He
okay.
said apparently he was crying while he did it, because it was such a sad thing. And that's pretty amazing for a maintenance guy to be crying anyway.
Yeah.
I showed you how much emotion was around that swimming pool.
So I can appreciate the guests, the paying guests, would go sit on the lounge chairs at the pool,
mm-hmm.
and the campers that had hiked into the campground there at the ranch, the Bright Angel campground,
mm-hmm.
would drop their packs and walk over to the pool and jump in.
Right.
And the paying guests were like, well, who are you?
Right.
So I can appreciate there would be some questions there.
Mm-hmm.
If the pool specifically was for guests and was not a public pool, then Fred Harvey would, you know, would have been kind of, I guess, in their right to say, well, we need a way to get those people out of our pool for our
mm-hmm.
guests.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
But they wouldn't do it, so.
Have you ever found any of that in writing anywhere in the archives?
No.
Okay.
I don't know about it.
Well, we got some things to look up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how?
I know the son of the son of the one guy that told them they're going to have to close the pool unless they did all that stuff.
You know, a lot of this might be in Kim Beesom's museum, in the museum collection that the park operates at the South Rim.
Sure.
If you knew what files to look in, I bet there would be some record there.
I'm sure it is.
And Franz Rotter, R-O-T-T-E-R, F-R-A-N-Z. Franz talked about that because he was managing the pool at the time. He was the general manager for Fred Harvey.
Oh, really?
And so he talked about that in his oral history a little bit, of, you know, the whole deal from his perspective.
Is he the same, I mean, is that the same family that owns the lodges on the south, in Tucson?
Yes.
Rotter?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, he was the manager at Fred Harvey and then quit that and went out to Tucson to start the hotels out there.
I'll be darned.
So, you know, trying to piece this story together of, you know.
Yeah, oh, for sure. I know, it's amazing how things come together and come apart and come back together.
Yeah, yeah. So, you mentioned Roy, that's Starkey, S-T-A-R-K-E-Y, had been working on this irrigation system that went into the pool and then out of the pool and back into the creek. Today, there's an irrigation system that is run sometimes to water the big cottonwood trees there. Is that part of the same system or is that a newer system? Do you know?
No, that's the same system.
Okay.
Same system. Yeah, and, you know, the thing about the irrigation ditches, it's not just, you know, a little job, but every spring he had to dig them back out.
Wow.
Because they'd get so full of mud from times when the creek was muddy.
Okay.
And so, you know, when flash floods came down the creek, for example, it would fill up the irrigation ditches with muddy water, which was going slower than, of course, then the mud would settle out. And you get a whole year of that. And so they had to be dug out every year.
Sure.
Not an easy job, you know, just basically a shovel and trying to get them all to run right, you know. You know, you have to get, you know, if the water level's too high at one of the places where they split, or it's too, excuse me, if it's too high on one side, then the other side doesn't run, or too low, I guess, on one side, then the other side doesn't run.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I worked on that quite a bit, too, with Roy.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah, that was one of this big springtime jobs. That was getting the air conditioner, or the swamp coolers. You had to, you know, change all the what's that called?
The pads?
The pads, anyway. They all had to be changed. Excelsior, that there's a roll of, he'd get these rolls of Excelsior he brought down by mule, and then he'd have to cut them so that they fit into the three sides of the swamp cooler, and then kind of chisel out the calcium carbonate that formed in all the pipes.
I bet it did. Oh, my gosh.
It was a big job, yeah, keeping those things running.
You have to get in there with a wire brush.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And then would you put down some tar in the pan in the bottom?
No.
Okay.
No, but it's mostly it was getting, you know, you'd have to take a wire and push the wire through the copper tubing.
Oh.
To get them cleared out so that they ran clearly, or they ran well enough to keep the pads wet. And you know, I mean, if you have a pad that's not getting wet, then warm air comes through that pad. So.
Right. Let me see if I can describe this. There's a water under pressure, and that gets tapped with a copper line that's probably like a quarter inch outside diameter, fairly small.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes to a float valve, some sort of a check valve,
mm-hmm.
that keeps the water in a tank at the bottom of the cooler at a level. And then there's a pump. When you turn the cooler on, the pump would pump water up to the top of the Excelsior pads, dribble the water down through these wood shavings, and the air would be drawn through by a big squirrel cage fan?
Yeah, it was a round, big, kind of little, like a barrel with flaps on, little, like probably 1 inch flaps all the way around it, so as it spins, it sucks water through the Excelsior, and which sucks air through the Excelsior, through the wet Excelsior, which cools the air off.
Got it.
And then the cool air gets blown into the building.
How many of those swamp coolers were down there at the time?
Oh my God! Well, there was 11 cabins, and the lodge had three of them, so that's 13, and the manager's cabin is 14, and the employee dorm was 15, so at least 15.
Okay, if 11 cabins each had one, that's 11. If the lodge had three, now that's 14. Manager's cabin had one, that's 15. Employee's dorm had one, that's at least 16.
Oh, there you go. Uh-huh.
That was just the Fred Harvey. That's not the National Park Service lodges Ranger Station and quarters.
No, we don't have to do that, but...
But that's a ton of coolers to keep going.
Yeah, it is.
Wow. And so that would be your job in the spring, was to get those things up and going?
Well, it wasn't my job. It was Roy's job.
Ah.
But I would help. There was... One year after Roy left, that was the year they put in the new septic system, and so it was just me and Myla and Deb Marr. We were the only ones down there.
So hang on.
Yeah.
Did you just mention Myla Morcheck?
Yes, I did.
Okay, that's Myla, Morecheck.
I don't think there's an E in it. Morcheck.
Check. Okay. Morcheck. When did you first meet Myla?
Oh, gosh. Well, when she first came down, it was pretty funny because she came down and she had, I don't know, she must have changed shoes before she got to the ranch because she walked, we saw her walk past the window for the employee dining room, which was on the back side of the lodge, and she walked by and she had high-heeled shoes on.
Ooh.
High heel shoes and lipstick, and her hair was all done up and stuff, and we're like, holy smokes, what is that? And she came in the back door and with her typical loud voice, hi, how's everybody doing?
Hmm.
It was pretty fun.
What year was that?
Oh, boy. Well, that'd be probably, it would be in the 70s. 70, I'm guessing 78, maybe.
Okay. And was she coming down for work?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, she had, this was when Don Weir was the manager at Phantom Ranch.
W-E-I-R?
Yeah. And she apparently had slept with him to get the job at Phantom Ranch. Or at least that's what she told everybody.
Okay.
And we're all going, ew!
So that was Myla. And how long did she work there?
Well, let's see. Starting in 1980, so I would guess 5 years.
Okay. Tell me another Myla story.
I'd have to think about that. Myla's story. She was always talking about beefcakes. She was, you know, she'd try to make plays on whoever was down there at the time. She called them a beefcake.
Hmm.
Here's a story. One time, she came down. It was morning. And she came. She was late to work anyway, and she came down and came into the kitchen, and she's kind of, and we found her kind of doubled over, on the counter in the back of the kitchen. And what's the matter? And she said, I think I'm having a heart attack. And we're like, oh my God, you know, of course, you know, the bottom of the Grand Canyon is no place to have a heart attack. So so we, of course, called the Rangers. The Rangers came down and they checked her out and they went, oh my God, we've got to get her out of here. And they called down a helicopter, which came down and took Myla out and took her to Flagstaff, to the hospital, and it turned out it was just gas.
Oh, my gosh.
So she got a free trip out of the canyon just because she had gas.
Oh, my gosh. And then she'd have to make her way from Flagstaff back to work.
Well, of course, yeah, but I think she stayed out for a few days.
Okay.
As I recall, since she was out, she didn't climb it and go into the canyon or, you know, go down the trail. Unless you could go on a mule, of course. You know, that worked sometimes where one of the dudes had gotten sick on the way down or something like that. And so there was an extra mule going out. She would take that immediately if she could arrange it, you know, to get the days off, you know, get her days off changed so she could go out on her mule.
Hmm. Okay. And the Phantom Ranch manager would have the flexibility to rework the schedule and make that happen if somebody.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it might mean that there's one less person making beds, or no, it wouldn't be that. What would they use that for? Well, anyway, yeah, the manager would maybe have to skip some of the lodge duties or something like that
mm.
to get a free up an employee to cover a shift.
Okay. Hey, Keith, let's go back for a minute to Roy Starkey.
Okay.
Do you remember the year that Roy quit?
Well, he didn't exactly quit. Actually, what happened, let me think, how did that work? What happened was, he was, well, he always had some form of dementia as far as we were down there. It was not enough to keep him from working, though. But it was enough to where he couldn't really do, like if there was a big job, he couldn't do that. He didn't know how to do that. But he was good at, like, keeping the ditches clear and doing the swamp coolers and, you know, jobs that don't take much in terms of figuring out. He could do those, but
okay.
If it came to something else, he wasn't so great at it.
Okay.
Anyway, how did he get? He ended up getting flown out for some reason. It was like, you know, it was like the Terry, who was the manager, wasn't trying to get rid of him, but there was something going on with his sister in Phoenix, who didn't think that Roy should be down there, and thought that he should be in a home somewhere, and we were all like, no, don't put Roy in a home. You know, he's fine down here. And so he was kind of protected down there anyway. But when so anyway, I don't remember how he got up to the rim, but he was on the rim and wanting to come back down. And I was on the rim on my days off. And I, you know, got together with Roy, and he wanted to go down, but he didn't have any hiking boots or anything. He'd must have come out in the helicopter. So, he was willing to hike down there, but we had to get him hiking boots. And at the time, the train station was Brad Jones had somehow procured a job at the train station, and Brad Jones and oh God, what's the crazy guy's name? Well, anyway, I'll think of his name in a minute. But anyway, they found him some shoes that fit, so we, you know, we got a ride out to the trailhead, and he and I walked down together. It was a hard hike for him, you know. He kept stopping, going, God, my feet hurt, and we discovered about halfway down that he had two different, you know, he had a right shoe from one kind of shoes and a left foot shoe for another kind of shoes.
Wow.
They didn't match. So they got at the train station. Was, you know, that was a place where you could get camping supplies, and they sold boots and shoes and backpacks and stuff like that at the train station. And the train station kind of, because Brad was a big friend of ours, Topping is the name I was trying to think of. Brad Jones and Bob Topping. Bob Topping was one of those people that would come down to Phantom Ranch often, and spend a couple of weeks and eventually go back out and kind of on his own, sort of a free spirit, on his own schedule. There's a lot of that kind of thing going on back then.
Okay.
So
Roy's got two different types of shoes on.
Yeah.
And they're killing his feet. He's only halfway down.
Yeah. Well, we got calmed down.
Okay.
You know, we ended up hiking on the way down. And he recovered from that. But then he realized that he wasn't able to do things down there anymore.
Mm.
And really wanted to go back, go out and go to Phoenix with his sister and so I remember him sitting quite dejectedly because he really didn't have a job down there anymore at the helicopter pad, just kind of sitting there with his hands on his chin, or his chin on his hands and his elbows on his knees, just like, how am I going to get out of here? Because he wasn't able to hike out anymore. So anyway, eventually a helicopter was arranged for, you know, I mean, was going anyway. So they took Roy out, and that was the last, it wasn't the last we saw him. We saw him once, I saw him once at a home in Scottsdale, I think it was. But he didn't really know who we were, and, you know, his dementia had gotten a lot worse.
Yeah. So no going away party, no recognition?
No. No, there wasn't.
And there's a...
He just kind of all of a sudden was snatched out of there. And
yeah. There's a beach, not much of one anymore because the sand's all gone, upstream of the Kaibab suspension bridge called Roy's Beach.
Right.
Do you know how that beach got its name? And,
well, it was where Roy was basically a nudist. He loved to go down and take off all his clothes and jump in the river. Of course, you have to get back out immediately because it's so cold. The water's so cold. But anyway, when it's 110 degrees, it feels pretty good for a few seconds.
You bet.
But the reason it's called Roy's Beach is that I'm guessing, again, this is the reason it's called Roy's Beach. It was called that before I started working down there. But the reason is it was under the cable that Roy used to use to measure the river. You know, he was first down there as an employee of the U.S. Geological Survey back in the 60s, I believe, measuring the river, and there was a cable across the river there, right over what's called Roy's Beach, or it's just beyond over that anyway. There's a trail, you know, the trail to Roy's Beach. There's
yes,
you know, if you step over off the Kaibab just after it crosses the Black Ridge, there's a trail there, and if you keep going down that trail, if you go beyond where you leave it to go down to Roy's Beach, if you keep going, it takes you to a cable car, or used to anyway, a cable car, which was basically a wooden box. Have I talked about this before?
I
don't remember.
I'm not sure. Go ahead.
Anyway, it's a wooden box, and it has a seat on each end. It's probably maybe 5 feet long, and there's a seat on each end, and it has a crimping tool. It's kind of about the size of a big pipe wrench.
Uh-huh.
That is hanging on the cable that crosses the river, and there's a hook that the box is hooked to. It's got a lock on it, of course, but a government lock. So, but anyway, Roy had the key in it, and one time he took me for a ride on it. It was a pretty amazing trip because you get in the box, and then he got in the shore side of the box, short end of the box. I was on the other end, and it took some doing to pull the box enough to where you could unhook the hook, but he'd unhook the hook, and then he had the crimping tool, which is hanging from the cable, on his over his shoulder, over his right, his shoulder, and he just got it unhooked and let go, and there are pulleys that the box is held, is hanging from, and the box is, once you set it free, starts rolling down the cable, and the cable is pretty steep downhill to start with, and of course as you go across the cable, by the time you're in the middle of the river, it's fairly flat, and then you start going up the other side of the cable, which is coming uphill. So after the fun ride down the cable and across the middle of the river, you start going up the hill, and the cable, of course, because it's uphill, the box goes slower and slower, and eventually you have to start using the crimping tool. And the way that works is basically a handle that's going up and down, that's vertical, and you push, you lean forward, and as forward as you can, and then pull back on the crimping tool, and it grabs the cable, and then you pull, and it pulls you up, then up the cable as far as your back will let you do it, and then you push it forward. When you push it forward, then it releases the cable, but you have to, push it forward fast, catch the cable again, and pull back. So it's kind of like rowing a boat in a way.
But you got
to
be...
That's what you had to do to get all the way across the river.
Quick anyway, and strong, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, Roy would do that, and then at different places along the river, he'd stop and he'd drop... instruments down into the river. There was a box, a little cabinet sort of thing that was built into the wall on the north side of the river, right there. The south side of the river, on the south side of the river, right there where the cable came to.
Right.
But anyway, so what he'd do is get his equipment out of the box and then go back across the river and measure it at different places several times a day, measure the temperature and the speed of flow at different levels of the river for the U.S. Geological Survey. And anyway, he'd keep all that information and then have to send it up by mule, when he got a week's worth of information. Anyway, that was his job.
And didn't he have a radio? Didn't he have
cable? That was Roy's cable.
Okay.
And, under it. Apparently, you know, after doing all that, he was all hot and sweaty. So he, you know, climbed down to the closest place where you can get to the river, which is Roy's Beach, take off all his clothes and jump in.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how, that's, I believe, is why it's called Roy's Beach. But,
okay. And he had a radio. I think they had radio communication to get their data out of the station as well. Is that right? Do you remember that?
Well, of course, this is all before I worked there. So
got it. Okay.
I don't know. That's not what he said, but I had, or that, I don't know.
Okay.
He could have, I suppose. I don't know, because radio communication, you know, the Park Service radios, I had one for a while because I ended up working for the Park Service. So
mm-hmm.
You couldn't really talk to the rim on the park radio.
Right.
Back then, anyway.
Yeah, in researching an earlier person that worked at the stage gauge, they would, he in his writings, he mentioned the radio and that every day they would call in at a certain time and they could talk to the other stage gaugers up and down the river if there was a flood happening or things like that. So share a little news. Do you know that you mentioned Roy had a sister in Phoenix?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember her name?
No.
Okay.
I never met her.
Okay.
No, it was, you know, they kind of, she had a bad reputation amongst Phantom Ranchers because she was trying to get Roy out of there. You know, in her opinion, he was beyond the point of usefulness down there and really needed to be in a home much safer than he was at the bottom of the canyon. He also had saved a lot of money because, of course, he'd just stay at the bottom of the canyon all the time and get paychecks. So,
right.
He had quite a bit of money, apparently. I don't know how much, but that was another part of the rumors that she was after his money. But I can't say that was true or not.
Yeah.
I don't know. Because I never met her, and I don't even know how much money Roy had.
I just wonder if he had any photographs, whether they're still in existence. So, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know how you would find them, even if he did.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've been talking for almost an hour here. Maybe this is a good place to put a comma in this, and we'll pick up part 6 down the road. What do you think?
Okay, I just have to remember what stories I've told and what I haven't told.
Right, and I'll try to help you with that.
Good.
as well, we still have Gail Burek.
Right.
Burke, is that right? That's Burke.
No, Burak.
Burak. Okay. So we want to talk about Gail and other people you remember that were there when Myla showed up.
Yeah, there's Bob Topping too.
Right, Bob Topping.
Quite a character.
And I think the at the train station, wasn't that Grand Canyon Trail Guides?
Yeah, that was. Oh, yeah, you're right.
Okay, so you can tell me Grand Canyon Trail Guides stories.
Right.
Okay. All right. Well, we've got some things to talk about next time, but we do want to keep focusing on Nancy as well. To be continued with that, this will conclude part 5, Oral History with Keith and Nancy Green. Today is Saturday, December 5th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. And Keith and Nancy, thank you so very much.
You bet. Well, it's fun to remember these things.
Cool. Hang on.